All right, good morning and welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. It is November 16th, 2011. And welcome back. Hopefully, we'll have our other committee member here shortly, but we're going to go ahead and get started because we have a lot on the agenda today. For about half of the agenda, as you can see, we're going to focus on forestry issues. So we have a whole lineup of people this morning. I will mention that the governor's office staff person will be here, and he needs to leave by 9:15, so we may have to cycle him in when he shows up. But I'd like to invite up the Department of Forestry. He's going to talk about several issues that I've asked them to give us a further explanation about. And welcome. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
And there should be some handouts in front of you as well. Beth, why don't you, do you want to maybe talk a little bit about the handouts, and then we'll hand it off to the department?
You know, I think the department has just turned in some handouts, but we don't have any beyond that.
IMST? Yes, this is, I don't know if everyone.
No, I didn't. I did not, but okay. I can have copies made.
Yeah, I think that would be good, actually.
That was emailed to the members. But
right. Do you? So I'm asking Beth to make a copy of the IMST report, and Doug, you'll probably be talking about that as well in addition to the INR. So I'll hand it off to you.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Decker, Oregon State Forester. I'm joined this morning by Peter Doherty, the chief of our private forests division, and Mike Caffaretta will be up in a moment, the deputy chief of our state forest division, to talk about the LA State Forest. We appreciate the invitation to be here to join you this morning. We're going to touch on several topics that Chair Dingvelder and the committee have expressed some interest in, and we've been staying in touch since July, providing the chair with some periodic updates over a cup of coffee on topics related to administration of the Forest Practices Act and related to state forests. During the summer, we had the opportunity to work closely with Senator Thompson related to the Dollar Lake fire up on the Mounted National Forest. And this fall, I've been working closely with our board and with the governor's office to map out our work plans for our three key businesses, fire, forest, and forest practices and state forests. And you may have read or heard the governor's testimony before the board from 2 weeks ago, in which he encouraged the board to clarify its expected outcomes from state forests and to reexamine its specific strategies for achieving those outcomes. He asked us to consider how we would establish some focused conservation areas on state forest land, and to do this in a way that's consistent with providing revenues to the counties and kind of operating within a workable business model, a sustainable business model as well. During his comments, the governor also focused on the role of federal land in Oregon and the importance of using active management as a way of delivering on a whole variety of community and economic environmental benefits from those federal lands as well. It was an interesting conversation. So today, the chair has asked us to take about 20 minutes or so to provide an update on several pieces related to our businesses. First is the pace and the results of a review that we're underway with right now about our administration of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. As you may recall, we received two budget notes at the close of the session, last session, and have worked diligently with our Ways and Means Subcommittee and with stakeholders to conduct the work of the budget notes, which promises to be completed under budget and under timeline, ahead of timeline as well. And Peter's going to walk us through those pieces here in just a moment, and there's a piece related to that in your handout. The chair also asked us to provide an update on two state forest topics, which we'll do. The results of a science review that was conducted by the Institute of Natural Resources that the Board of Forestry requested, and a status report on the Elliott State Forest Management Plan, which was recently approved both by the State Land Board and by the Board of Forestry. So Mike will focus on that, and we're also pleased to have Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands, for whom we manage the Elliott, here in the room to join us if we have some questions for her as well. So with that, unless there are any further questions at this point, I'm going to ask Peter if he would begin to walk us through the forest practices piece.
Why don't you go ahead, Peter, and then we'll see if there's questions after your presentation.
Good.
Thank you.
Great. Mm-hmm.
Chair Dean,
Felder, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Peter Doherty, Private Forest Division Chief. We appreciate the opportunity to provide an update on implementing legislative budget direction in the private forest program. In terms of your handout, I'll be talking about what's called Attachment 1, which is our testimony prepared for tomorrow for the Ways and Means Committee. The department's private forest program provides resource protection on Oregon's 10.6 million acres of privately owned forest land through the implementation of the Forest Practice Act, landowner education, and other activities. The department's 2011-13 budget restored much of the capacity the program lost in the 09-11 session. The bill appropriated resources for field administration of the Forest Practice Act, including stewardship foresters and technical specialists. It provided resources for effectiveness monitoring and compliance auditing of the Forest Practice Act and for the Forest Health Program, including continued monitoring and eradication of sudden oak death. As Doug mentioned, the bill also contained two budget notes, one directing the department to hire an independent contractor to audit compliance with the Forest Practice Act, and the second to contract with an independent third party to assess and make recommendations on cost savings, efficiencies, and cost avoidance strategies that could prove effective in Forest Practice Act administration. And that budget note two had a short time frame for 1 year. We were asked to report back in June of 2012 on the progress we made. So in conjunction with stakeholder input and budget note direction, we've developed a budget implementation plan to restore capacity and to address the concerns raised in the budget notes. Our intent's not to rebuild the program we had prior to 2009, but rather to use 21st technology to deliver services that are appropriate for today. And so this morning I'm going to give you a brief update on the plan and the progress we've made to date. So the plan, the budget implementation plan, really has three parts. One is phasing in resources to rebuild capacity, and we're doing that in a prudent manner. The second is to plan for the contracting out of the compliance audit. And third is contracting with that independent third party for the efficiency analysis. So in terms of phasing in resources based on legislative direction and stakeholder input, we developed some principles. The first is to really recognize the concerns for efficiency. The second is to free up resources to do contract out some of our services. And the third is to recognize immediate capacity needs while allowing flexibility in the future. And so I want to talk a little bit about our progress in restoring resources, focusing on the administration of the Forest Practice Act. And I'm really going to focus on two things, our field foresters and our technical specialist. In the reductions, we went from 57 field foresters to 30. And 30 is really inadequate to provide minimum service level. So we immediately moved forward with to add 12 positions, essentially one in each district across the state, to meet minimum standards and retain capacity that was being maintained on limited duration. We've completed that. Eight of those positions were brought off the layoff list that and retained expertise in both forest practices and fire protection.
So, Peter, so you've added back eight of the 12 is what you're saying?
No, we've actually added back all 12. Okay. Eight of them were previous employees and four of them were done through open competitive. In terms of technical specialist, we really wanted to evaluate which technical specialist positions were critical for continuity of resource protection and to meet minimum regulatory responsibilities. And in this first phase, we had our field operations staff come up with a potential list of technical specialists, and then we had that list reviewed and prioritized by the Board of Forestry appointed Regional Forest Practices Committee. And two key positions were identified, a wildlife specialist to look at special resource sites such as spotted owls, and a water quality specialist to address issues like the coastal zone management, forest roads, sediment delivery, and other water quality issues. We're moving forward with the wildlife specialist, and we've postponed the hiring of the other technical specialist until after the February session because of concerns about revenue. So that's kind of, we have a plan. It's staged to do restoration of our resources, but to move forward in a prudent manner. With budget note one, to contract out the compliance audit, we're planning to design the audit to allow the production stage to be done by an independent third-party contractor while retaining quality assurance and quality control within the department. We will use an external review committee to evaluate the design of the audit, including representatives from the 3-4 certification systems active in Oregon. Where we're at with that is we needed to add some expertise for the design of the audit. We have recruited a specialist to lead our effectiveness monitoring program. That person will come on in mid-December, and the first task that person will have is to design the audit and prepare the RFP for putting out to contract. We're planning to use our design from our 2002 compliance audit to allow rapid implementation while we do continuous improvement. We expect to have the initial design and request for proposal completed by March of 2012. And the last task which we have, which was to look at the efficiency analysis of our Forest Practice Act administration. The principles we used in developing that plan was to focus specifically on forest practice administration, both the field administration with our stewardship foresters as well as the need for technical specialists. We're using it as a pilot project for our General Forest Business Improvement Initiative. We decided to use a Department of Administrative Services approved lean business processing provider so we could rapidly implement this analysis. And we are going to use the results of the lean analysis to develop a plan that addresses all required processes, policy, and data related issues, and provide a structured approach for the application of technical solutions to these issues. In your handout, there's a diagram of our planned implementation of the efficiency analysis. We've completed the design of this initiative, and this week we're completing the final analysis section of that. So I'm going to just kind of highlight. In June, we moved forward with this. We began review and selection of a DAS-approved lean provider. We ended up with Geeden Performance Solutions. We identified a project and core team of field foresters, unit foresters, and administrative staff who do the field administration. We identified industrial forests, non-industrial foresters, forest owners, and operator participants. We held a scoping session with the core team, landowners, agency leadership, board of forestry members, and legislators. Based on that scoping session, we developed a contract and scope of work and hired a contractor. And in the past couple months, we completed the value stream mapping of the Forest Practice Act Administration. We completed the first Kaizen event, which focused on inspection and reporting of inspections, which is a key part of our field administration. And we're currently this week conducting the second Kaizen event focused on the standardization of the notification process. Just to give you an idea, the first Kaizen event, as I mentioned, focused on inspections. And to give you the idea of the way this analysis works, our current state process in doing inspections has 42 steps, 17 decisions, and 14 delay points. And after this week Kaizen event, the field foresters and unit foresters have defined a future state that only has 18 steps, 7 decisions, and only 5 delay points. So just a rapid improvement in our process will be, after the second Kaizen event, we will be doing next steps planning and preparing the report, which we will bring to the February session 6 months ahead of schedule. So that's what kind of a summary of where we're at with this, and I'm glad to answer any questions you have.
Any questions for the department on this?
I have some other questions. I'm not sure when's appropriate.
Okay. On some of the other topics, or just on this part of the presentation?
Different topics.
Okay. So we'll wait.
Question on this part.
Yeah.
You've brought some efficiency to this process. Will these efficiencies carry forward for all future projects?
Because we're using this as a pilot approach, this kind of technique for doing business process modeling as a first step in doing any sort of technological improvement is something we're planning to use. We have, by prudently implementing our restoration of resources, we've held back salary savings, which the next step for this would be to pilot the new system, the future state system, in a district with a outside provider to begin to do that implementation. It's one thing to come up with a new process. The key will be getting it applied on one district as a pilot and then adopted to all of our other districts.
Yeah, and just to follow up to that, I'm assuming that we won't know the total either, cost or efficiency savings until we get the results of that pilot. So what is the timing? I know you mentioned that as far as the length of the pilot. I know you'll have the report, but when will the actual pilot be conducted where we'll have more concrete results and have a better sense of where this is going for the future?
We're planning on conducting the pilot shortly after the February session. Right now, we're also planning a 10.5% reduction, and depending on what revenue sources we have after the February session will kind of affect how fast we can implement some of these.
Although I'm sure you know that this could be a way to make up that shortfall if you can deliver the services more effectively and efficiently, especially with less time to turn those the forest plans around. Question is, how are you going to decide? Have you already decided where you're going to do the pilot?
No, at this point we haven't selected a district to do the pilot. It would be one of the districts that's currently participating in the Kaizen event because they have the most buy-in since they designed that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions on this component? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. So our next set of topics are related to the Elliott State Forest and the Institute for Natural Resources report. And joining me at the table here is Mike Caffaretta.
Yeah, and I was going to say, why don't we have Louise Soliday come up as well? Or she was here. All right, when she comes back in, we'll rope her in.
Great.
She probably left just at the perfect time when we were. But she's part of the involved with that land board decision, I think it would be good in case we have any questions. Would you go ahead?
Very good.
You probably need to start from the beginning about the Elliott State Forest Management Plan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Caffaretta. I'm the Deputy Chief of the State Forest Division here at the Department of Forestry. And you picked two of the very interesting topics that we have going on in the Department of Forestry, among many others that we would enjoy giving you an update on. And you know, we manage about 830,000 acres of forest land out of Oregon's 30 million acres. And I'm going to hold up a textbook here when we talk about the Common School Fund lands, because they're sort of two different land bases, and sort of it's hard to keep them always clear. So the Common School Fund lands are managed for the benefit of Oregon schools. So that's, we're talking about this, and that's the Elliott State Forest. And the other side, I didn't bring any props in, but the Board of Forestry lands managed by the Board of Forestry, that's the Tillamook State Forest, and those are a little bit different. So, you know, all these are relatively young stands. The Elliott probably is our oldest timber. It originated after a fire in 1868, and it's about 90,000 acres on the south coast. And the other lands, quite a bit younger, the Tillamook State Forest, you know, 40s and 50s. These lands are now 60 and 70 years old. And then I might also mention our Gilchrist State Forest. A real exciting event for us is purchasing the Gilchrist. It's also very young. It reflects our history of bringing land into the fold when they're cut over or burned over and then restoring them to active working forests provide a range of benefits. On the revenue side, on the Common School Fund side, you know, when we're managing these lands, our costs go against the Common School Fund, and the Department of State Lands pays those fees, and the revenue we earn goes into the Common School Fund. On the Board of Forestry lands, a little bit different. On those lands, we keep 36% of the revenue, and we have to run our management off of that 36%. It's been really difficult in these environment, in this economic environment, because the timber prices are low, and we've had to take a number of reductions in order to keep within our management share. And so throughout my tenure here at the department, there's been active policy debate. That debate continues today. And greatest permanent value is the mandate we manage these Board of Forestry lands under, and we'll talk about that a little bit, or we can. And that's sort of under constant discussion. And also even under the Elliott plan, you know, folks have different ways they like forests in Oregon to be managed, and that's also been a very active policy debate. Science plays a very important role, and it informs those discussions, and the policy is also very important. You asked about our work with the Institute for Natural Resources, and I appreciate that. The INR was created by the Oregon Legislature in 2001, and they try to bring the scientific knowledge to bear on these natural resource questions. They're housed at Oregon State University, but they really try and involve all the university systems, so not just the expertise at Oregon State, but Portland State has some really outstanding folks, as well as the University of Oregon and around the state and other places. And so they try and help us identify and use relevant science in making policy choices. And when we involved them, and the Board of Forestry involved them, we had a very active policy debate. We still do, but it was particularly intense then. We had done a lot of analysis to help inform the different choices that the Board of Forestry was facing. And you know, we had done a lot of work at narrowing down options for managing the Northwest Oregon State Forest. This is on the Board of Forestry side. And we had weeded out a bunch of options that come down to two different possibilities. We did some analysis trying to decide and help the board understand what would be the different outcomes if they made a choice between these two different ones. And after we had done that, we went to the INR and had them review that. And we had a number of questions for them. You know, we asked if our work was consistent with the science in each field. We asked if our conclusions were supported by our analysis. We asked them about the weight of evidence. We also asked them about other ways to conduct the analysis. So we had this active policy debate. We had to make a choice, but if there's other better ways to make comparisons between forest management plans, they might have some good ideas about that. We asked them other ways to conduct the analysis. We also asked them how we can better measure the environmental benefits, the economic benefits, the social benefits, because it is very difficult, and it's hard to have a conversation about what you want without good ways to discuss it. So we asked them for other ways to measure those things that the Board of Forestry was interested in. They completed their report and brought it to the Board of Forestry in April of last year. We appreciated that work. We're still in the process of following up on that report. And sort of the biggest thing we're doing right now is for the Board of Forestry in their 2012 work plan, so starting this January, is looking at how do we better measure the benefits that come from state forest lands. Now, some of the folks, our stakeholders, consider that to be a little bit bureaucratic, and I can understand that and maybe appreciate that in some ways. But also, it's hard to have conversations about what you want to come from the forest if you don't have an established way to talk about it. And when they passed the Forest Management Plan in 2001, we didn't have performance measures, or I understand they didn't have performance measures. So there were a lot of expectations, but they weren't written down, and they were hard to check in on, and they were hard to weigh against each other. And so as the board has gone through a process of coming up with performance measures, that helps us have a conversation about what do you expect. And the Institute for Natural Resources gave some ideas that we need to improve those and some ideas of how to improve those. And we think that's really fundamental work to take the recommendation, and the board's had that on their agenda for a long time to improve those. And what that does is becomes the foundation for how do we ask, is this the right forest management plan? Having a good set of outcomes everybody shares expectations around, then we can ask, is this the best way to achieve those outcomes, or if we want to evaluate other ways, we can do that. Also for the board, there's some other things we want to work on that are still on the plate as recommendations from the INR. better integrate the use of science in the planning rule. Also talk about scale. You know, we're talking about forest-wide, or we do analysis at all sorts of scales, watershed levels, site analysis, forest-wide analysis. But how do we talk about that in the planning rule and looking at scale as a recommendation from the INR? Also, in the agency, they gave us a lot of recommendations that we're working on. In the agency side, we're still working to clarify what they asked us. We have some, we put it down for a little while to work on the Elliott plan. We're picking that back up to go back and ask them and talk to them about what they said and make sure we understand it. We're starting a big effort to rewrite our research and monitoring plans to take into account some of the things, the uncertainties that are out there that they pointed out, to understand those. And as part of that, we really want to try and strengthen the links we have between scientists and managers. So this, in many ways, is going to shape our work plan in 2012, both at the board level and also within the department, is learning from and responding to and working with those experts.
Can I ask a quick question as far as the work plan? What's the length, what's the scope of, is it a five-year plan, 10-year plan, 20-year plan, strategic plan? I mean, work plan is usually a shorter time frame, but what's
right.
the time frame for that?
The Board of Forestry has a system where they will adopt basically two-year work plans for each of our different businesses. And so what we're working with them right now is probably four or five key items for their their calendar year 2012 work plan. And so there are some pieces that we will move forward that they may choose to move forward from this current work cycle. The INR work that Mike has talked about, I think, will be, you know, a natural. There are some other pieces kind of following on some of the, you know, some of the suggestions that the governor made when he came to talk to the board that may end up also on the 2012 work plan. So that will really define their set of work for 12. And we're doing that as well in our fire business, and we're doing that in our private forest business as well.
And I'm assuming you have a longer-range strategic plan because, obviously, some of these are going to be need to be phased in.
Right. So just from a planning standpoint, the board has just adopted its forestry program for Oregon, which is kind of a 10-year aspirational document that talks about, several specific goals relative to Oregon's forests, and that's kind of our North Star. And then kind of within that, we're actually, at the agency level, we're developing a 7 to 10 year strategic plan that looks at our businesses and tries to give some continuity to each of our businesses in terms of reaching that North Star, and they can also help inform us as we build our budgets.
And I'm assuming that plan is available on your website, or you...
The Forestry Program for Oregon is definitely available on our website.
So yep. We'll send that out to committee members because I think it would be helpful to have that.
I think it would be, yep.
Madam Chair, I'd probably pause there before I move on to the Elliott, or I could do the Elliott stuff and then come back.
Now, why don't we wait and see if there's any questions on this, and then we can talk about the Elliott. Any questions on the planning process? No. Okay. Go ahead. And we're going to, right after that, we'll probably take a couple of quick questions and then have the governor's office come up, since I know that Mr. Brownscombe is under a tight time frame. So okay. I want to make sure and utilize his time to the fullest extent while he's here.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll move on to the Elliott State Forest. And again, now we're talking about the common school lands. And so I hold up my textbook here. My first grader's missing it this morning.
You stole it from your kids to bring it here. Okay.
Make a note of that.
Yeah.
Right. So about 90% of the Elliott State Forest is managed for the State Land Board by the Department of Forestry and the Department of State Lands. Net revenues from those timber sales go to benefit the Common School Fund. And so I guess the first thing I would say is we have a new forest management plan for the Elliott, and we're very glad about that. We think that it better meets the mandates of the Common School Fund lands for the Elliott, and it's been a long time. We've spent a lot of effort and a lot of work to get there, and the State Land Board and the Board of Forestry both recently adopted that new forest management plan. And that reflects sort of a closure of a long planning process. So I would say about that plan, it increases timber production. So the old plan, we looked at about 25 million board feet a year. This one, we hope we can get about 40 million board feet a year. And we have a series of models and experts to work on that, and we think that we can sustain that 40 million board feet indefinitely with all the constraints that we also do around water quality and threatened and endangered species management. And so we've done a lot of modeling, a lot of effort to make sure we think that is a sustainable harvest level. And, of course, with that comes higher revenue levels that support the Common School Fund. That forest management plan also provides conservation areas. About a third of the forest will be used for conservation needs, mostly including threatened and endangered species. There's a lot of marbled murrelets. There's a lot of spotted owls there. That also includes, there's a little bit of old growth on that forest. That is set aside under this plan, is protected. Also some steep and visual areas and things of that nature, unique areas, are protected. So about a third of the forest used for conservation areas. I mentioned the revenue. We think that will go from about $6 to $8 million a year to the $9 to $13 million a year net revenue to the Common School Fund. I think also in addition to that, the logs that flow off of that forest land, those are milled here in Oregon or in the United States. It could go into Northern California or Southern Washington, but mostly in Oregon on the coast as well as the Willamette Valley. And so there's some benefits there to the coastal communities and the Willamette Valley economic communities. And so we'll be implementing that plan. We're January 1st is our date to start working on it. I would just speak for a couple seconds about the process of that, that I mentioned it had gone on for a long time. I started my career on the Elliott in 1997 and left there in 1998, just about the time they started the committee to start working on that new forest management plan. And sort of what happened there, we had the plan adopted in 1995. It had a habitat conservation plan that went with it. That's an agreement with the federal services for how you'll manage around spotted owls and murrelets. At least that one was a two-species habitat conservation plan. The murrelet side of that expired 6 years later. We didn't know much about murrelets then, is my understanding, so it had a short-term timeline on it. And when that expired, we went to managing murrelets as we do now, which we call it take avoidance. We survey for them. When we find them, we maintain their habitat. And so when that expired, we then started the process of trying to get another one and trying to revise that habitat conservation plan to be more than just owls, but to be all the species that we manage there, including salmon species and the murrelet. We worked on that real hard for a long time. We're very hopeful about it. We went as far as developing a habitat conservation plan, doing a draft environmental impact statement, and that was very favorable. Came back with done by a third-party analysis, the environmental impact statement, and the difference between what we were doing and the new forest management plan had very small differences. That went out for public comment. Some of that, those processes, and in the end, the federal services and us, the Department of Forestry, we couldn't find a set of strategies that would meet their mandates as well as those for the Common School Fund. And so now we have the new forest management plan and where we manage for threatened and endangered species by surveying for them, and we have them maintain those species and their habitats on the landscape. So obviously throughout this time, a lot of concern from folks, a lot of questions internally we have about management as well as externally. We're starting a research and monitoring plan right now that will address those top questions. We have a history of doing that. We have research and monitoring plans that have been in place on other landscapes, including that one, and we have a history of funding research and learning from that research and making changes based upon that. We anticipate doing that here, and so we're putting together a research and monitoring plan, and will involve a wide set of stakeholders and the services in doing that process. And we're just starting that right now. We'll have that done, we think, in 6 or 9 months, depending on how long it takes. And the bottom line is we're looking forward to implementing this new forest management plan. It closes one chapter and opens another in the history of the Elliott State Forest. Happy to answer questions.
Well, I'm going to see if Louise wants to add anything from the land board perspective. Thank you for...
Sure.
Coming up, since you weren't officially on the agenda.
Yeah, and Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. Madam Chair, I guess the one thing I would say is for the land board, this has been a balancing issue. They have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize revenues off the lands that we manage for the Common School Fund, but we also have endangered species listed within the Elliott State Forest. And so there's this balancing act between the need to protect habitat for those species so that we don't take those species over time, while we're still trying to maximize the revenues that we can get out of the forest. When the land board adopted the plan, they put a couple of conditions on. One is that we do this research and monitoring program to make sure that we're managing adaptably, so that if the monitoring shows that we're having some adverse impacts that we weren't anticipating, that we can adapt the plan to address those. Second was that we continue to look at opportunities to generate revenues from carbon or other ecosystem services that the forest provides. provides, and that's an area that we've been pursuing and looking at for the last couple of years, and think that in the future that may be an option for additional way to generate revenue. The third thing is they wanted to leave open the option to come back and revisit whether a habitat conservation plan makes sense at some point in the future. And a habitat conservation plan gives you a lower legal risk, gives you more certainty in terms of your long-term management because you have coverage under the Endangered Species Act through that habitat conservation plan. Under this new plan where we're managing under a take avoidance strategy, you don't have that legal coverage, and so the potential for third-party lawsuits exists. We have to be very careful. The Department of Forestry has to be very careful as they're managing to make sure that we don't do anything that is going to result in the take of a species. So it's a balancing act. There's a weighing of the risks here. And I think, from my perspective, a habitat conservation plan would have been a much better alternative for managing this forest, given the number of illicit species that we have to manage around. But at the end of the day, we couldn't meet the fiduciary responsibility because it took away a lot of the flexibility in terms of how we manage that forest.
Okay, so we'll take questions and then for a few minutes, and then we're going to take a break and have the governor's office.
What's the time limit for the governor? Because I've got a number of questions.
Yeah, Brett, you have to be out of here at what time?
I need to speak at the Association of Oregon Counties meeting at 10:45. So.
How fast can he get to you, Gene?
Should be gone by 9:30.
Yeah, you should be gone by 9:30. So I'm wondering if we can have Brett come up and then recess you guys for a few minutes, and then we'll come back for questions and discussion. So if everyone's okay with that, I think everyone here is not going anywhere. Thank you. Brett, why don't you, you're in the hot seat now. And I'd asked the governor's office to provide us with an update on federal forest land management. We've been hearing about state forests, obviously, and Brett's going to provide us with an update on federal forest land management, and then we'll fire up questions to him, and then we'll pull up the previous panel to respond to other questions on Elliott, or you can also ask the governor's office if you want to about the Elliott. So welcome, Brett.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. So for those who I don't know, my name is Brett Brownscombe. I am one of Governor Kitzhaber's natural resource policy staffers and work alongside Richard Whitman, who you do know. So Senator and members, I'm also, if you want, I'm also prepared to address the ongoing working groups, so I can do that, but it sounds like the priority would be to start with an update on federal forest management. Okay.
And you probably have to provide some background for the newer members. I think they've been working hard to get up to speed on these issues, but it probably wouldn't hurt to give a little bit of background.
Okay. So on the federal forest front, what I'll get into eventually is what's happening in Congress as well as outside of Congress. And so the governor has made clear that both most recently in his Board of Forestry testimony and then previously that the federal forest issue in Oregon is something he's deeply concerned about, that with the state's land base being over 50% federal forest lands, anything that does or does not happen on those forests has a fairly dramatic impact on Oregon's rural communities and economy. And so he's continuing to prioritize management on federal forests, especially related to forest health, and especially related to two areas of the state, the East Side National Forest, as well as Southern Oregon. I shouldn't say only Southern Oregon, the Oregon and California lands, which extend up the west side of the Cascades, mostly clustered in Southern Oregon, but all the way up to Columbia County, actually. So those are the checkerboard lands that Congress transferred to the ONC Railroad Company and later took back and put into management under the ONC Act for a mix of benefits, including timber production and revenues to counties. So where I'll start with all this is the governor has structured his activity around federal forests in a variety of areas, and the first one is the Federal Forest Advisory Committee, which the Board of Forestry has adopted, staffed through the Department of Forestry, and it includes membership from a diverse collection of relevant interests, including the Forest Service, including the county's OFRI conservation interests, timber interests, and so it's a diverse group that has a mission of looking at, through the implementation working group, how to address barriers to increase scale of collaborative forest management. And so the intent is to address issues such as planning efficiencies and also address the work of collaboratives around the state. And so since the governor's first term, there's been a growth in the development and existence of local forest collaboratives that are community-based and that are working on building trust around the broken, fractured system of appeals and litigation over the federal forest issues and coming forward with common ground solutions that get at the forest health concerns. And so these forest collaborators are clustered around the state. They're locally based, they're diverse, they have, in our assessment, the best chance at rebuilding trust and actually gaining movement that is broadly supported on the federal forest lands. So the work of the Federal Forest Advisory Committee and the Implementation Working Group is aimed at trying to bolster the effectiveness of these collaboratives and address barriers to the effectiveness of landscape level restoration work. And the challenge is the collaboratives are functioning, but they are in need of capacity support as well as challenged by, we are challenging them as well as others to increase the landscape nature of the project work. And so move from acreage levels that are adequate to get work done on the local level, but not addressing the scale of the issue around forest health. And so the challenge is to broaden the work and try to look at how we achieve landscape level management and conservation.
Can you provide an example of these collaboratives? I mean, I think you're alluding to public-private partnerships, and you talked about the trust. Can you maybe give an example to illustrate for the committee what type of work is being done?
Sure. Yeah. So the one example is the Blue Mountain Forest Partners Collaborative is on the east side of the Malheur National Forest. There are others, including on the Sayuse Law and around the state. But in particular on that collaborative, they've been in existence now for a few years, and they've really brought the community together on fairly fractured political landscape in Grant County and Harney County and that portion of the state around federal forest management. So they've been gathering around the table and with the Forest Service moving forward on projects that have broad collaborative support. And so they're now moving forward on projects up to 40,000 acres in size that addressed fire risk and overall forest health. They have not seen litigation and appeals on their projects through a number of years now. And so there's a clear indication that the process is working in terms of finding common ground. And there's been a steady growth in the trajectory of acreage that they've been working to treat. They've run into some obstacles in terms of funding. And so this past year, the governor's office, through the Strategic Reserve Fund, we transferred dollars to that collaborative effort, and the dollars were actually run through the Harney County Soil and Water Conservation District that allowed them to get out and deal with layout of forest management projects and marking and move work from what was already completed in the NEPA planning process to the actual on-the-ground implementation, which resulted in it continues to result in task orders being let and jobs occurring on the ground. So that's how, that's one example of how the implementation working group is carrying out the work. It's a fairly responsive set of partners who are, if a problem flares up like the one I just mentioned, we get together and we address it. And then on some of the more global issues, such as the size and scale of landscape level restoration, as well as planning, we're focused on those through direct subcommittee processes. The other two areas I wanted to touch on, though, is the governor's role in the Western Governors Association. So he's reasserted, and then his work with the delegation in Congress. So on the WGA, the Western Governors Association, he has reasserted himself on the Forest and Wildfire Initiative, which is one of the key initiatives of the WGA. So on the Forest Health Advisory Committee, he's asserted his leadership role there and is working to bring the governors, bring the Western governors together around landscape level forest health and forest management work. He's also been working closely with the delegation in D.C. And this is talking about the D.C. situation. He traveled back there in October to meet with the delegation specifically around federal forests and specifically around the secure rural schools, county payments issue, as well as the Oregon and California lands issue. The way, and this was a precursor to his Board of Forestry testimony, where a lot of that testimony focused on the need for federal forest management. He really pushed on that issue with the board and indicated his interest in continuing to push with the delegation. So the result of the meeting in D.C. was some broad areas of agreement amongst the delegation over how to address the issues of forest management as well as county payments. And the result of that was a general agreement that the House and the Senate would take two different approaches, which ideally in the end will meet back up. So the House is focused on a management approach and the management side of the equation, and that's expressed through ongoing legislation developed by Congressman Walden as well as Congressman Hastings from Washington around federal forest management policy broadly. And within that legislation, it's expected that a Oregon and California lands title will exist.
And when you talk about land title, you're talking about transferring title or what, actual direct payments?
If I could get into that in one second, because I know it's of interest to you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee. The Senate side is focused on the secure rural schools reauthorization portion of this issue. And so through Senator Wyden's leadership, it's not exactly clear what vehicle this is going to take, but there is commitment amongst the delegation to working on both the secure rural schools county payments reauthorization piece as well as the forest management piece, with the House side taking the lead on the management side and the Senate side taking the lead on the secure rural schools side. Any reauthorization of secure rural schools would likely be at the 2011 dollar levels, which are reduced from where things were in 2007, the last reauthorization, as well as greatly reduced from where things started in 2000 after the Act's original passage. And at from those 2011 levels, the dollar values would scale downward. And so best case scenario, if reauthorization happens, there's likely still a need to address the financial stability issue facing Oregon counties. Not all counties face the same dire straits financially, but some are in fairly precarious shape. So there is still going to be a need to address the longer-term solution aside from secure rural schools reauthorization. I think the best that reauthorization could do would be to buy us some additional time as well as provide a bridge. On the management front, there have been proposals specific to the ONC lands, which you may have heard about through newspaper reports, but initially there was some discussion of selling lands. That idea has gone by the wayside as politically non-viable. There have been proposals around trusts, both splitting the ONC lands into two trusts, as well as a proposal which is backed by the Association of Oregon Association of ONC Counties to create a single trust where the lands could be managed for conservation values as well as timber production values. The some other elements of the proposals include ideas around management transfer, so the potential for another entity than the BLM to manage the lands. And the county's proposal is picks up on the resource advisory committees that are part of the Secure Rural Schools Act, which serve as a diverse collaborative structure to try to gain management clarity and common ground. Other interests have suggested the Forest Service could be a better manager of ONC lands. The general focus, though, is coming up with a solution on ONC lands that addresses funding stability and revenue stability for counties, economic benefits to timber production and forest-related jobs. The governor has indicated his priorities around this include both the economic benefit and community stability, revenue stability for counties elements, but also conservation benefit and the notion of shared responsibility. And on the conservation side of it, he's indicated that given the checkerboard nature of those lands, it presents difficult challenges for achieving conservation values, species recovery in particular, as well as fire management and timber management. So when you have industrial lands in one section of the checkerboard next to BLM lands in another section, and that checkerboard pattern exists across the landscape, it can create some real inefficiencies in trying to conduct management on the ground.
So Brett, we have about 7 minutes, and I know I have two members that would like to ask questions, so maybe we should pause there. Why don't you go ahead and ask a question, and I know Senator Brzezinski.
One for Brett and others for the agency.
Okay, so why don't you go ahead, and then we'll have Senator Brzezinski go.
Okay, thank you.
Brett, in all these management plans and anything like that, I've never heard any talk about the community health. We talk about the health of the forests and fire control, suppression, et cetera, and we talk about the common school fund. But what about the communities that live within these lands that are suffering because of the lack of timber production? Is that being discussed, or is it just are we more concerned with making sure that the forests stay there?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, yes, that's the community health issue is a central component of the discussions on ONC in particular. It's fairly well recognized that just working on the extension or reauthorization of Secure Rural Schools won't provide the long-term solution, and that there are revenue issues that are beyond that. And so dealing with a management solution that gets at revenue production from timber and then distribution of that revenue through communities and counties is a central element of the conversation. It's also a central element of the governor's priorities on this, so yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski.
So has the office taken a position on which of the plans we're favoring? You went over the two. I mean, the ones I've been reading a lot and been getting a lot of constituent stuff is on the, I want to call it the DeFazio plan, which is the two trust versus the single trust, which I know the counties are looking at. Has your office start taking positions as to what would be most accommodating for the concerns the governor's raised?
Chair Dingfelder and Senator Brzezinski, we have not, the governor's office has not weighed in on any substantive position at this time. So what I can tell you is that the House delegation is, we've been working closely with them on the ONC issue as well as the rest of the delegation on the Senate side. The House delegation, the House members in particular, are close. They've been working on bill language, and they're committed to a long-term plan that that addresses community stability on the revenue side, as well as timber production and bringing balance back to federal forests on the sustainable management sides. We have not seen specific language yet. The governor's interest in going back to D.C. in October was to work with the delegation to make sure that the conversations were moving forward on both Ski Roll Schools and ONC, and to make sure that we were getting to a place collectively where we could move something forward in Congress. Until we see the language, we haven't taken a position on what the House proposal would be. But what I can tell the committee is they're close. They've been putting in very long hours, and they're close to coming out with a proposal and in the very near future. And what we'll do at that point, once we see the language, is sit down, have a conversation with the delegation, and indicate our thoughts on the facets of that language. But until we see it, we haven't taken a position. We think all of the proposals have present interesting concepts that deserve exploration. There's a real opportunity, we feel, in doing something different on the ONC lands that can better create or better model an example moving forward on federal forest lands. So we're very interested in moving beyond the status quo of where things have been on those lands, and I think there have been, to the credit of those who have been working on the issue, a lot of outside-the-box proposals advanced.
All right. Before you leave, I'm going to ask you to give us two-minute updates on House Bill 3613 and 2873, if you could, and then we can follow up if you need to in writing with Beth that we can send out to the committee members. But in essence of time, I know you have to hit the road. Could you provide us with a quick update on both of those work groups? And you may want to just refresh the committee's memory about, actually, since both of these were House bills and not Senate bills.
Okay. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, the two work groups that we have are House Bill 2873 and House Bill 3613. So I'll start with House Bill 2873. The work group tied to that bill arose out of concerns over inline conduit hydropower production. So conduits tied to irrigation districts and producing hydropower within those conduits, those canals or ditches. And then doing so while still meeting the intent of Oregon's longstanding fish passage laws and policies. The work group is comprised of members of Oregon Water Congress, the irrigation districts, the conservation community, both on the water front, water rights front, in stream flow front, as well as the fish conservation front. We've met once. We generally reviewed where the issue has been and discussed some possible areas for moving forward. The next meeting will be in likely early December. The intent here is to resolve the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to resolve ODNW's approach to implementation of the Fish Passage Program and do so in a way that advances inline conduit hydro production in a way that still meets the intent of addressing fish passage. So what I mean by that is there are obstacles to moving forward on inline conduit work. Some of those obstacles are related to the implementation of the department's program on fish passage. Some of the obstacles are financial and related to the cost and the high expense of addressing some of these remaining fish passage barriers. The state's done a good job addressing a lot of the fish passage barriers across Oregon, but some still exist. And when you get into inline conduit work, it's been this push-pull with the fish passage policy that has presented the need to be addressed. And so we think there's a way, and for the governor's office, we're committed to both the inline conduit objectives as well as the fish passage objectives, and we feel like there's a way to address obstacles at the programmatic level through ODFNW and resolve issues that better advance inline conduit projects for hydro production while still getting a fish passage barrier removal. So.
Okay, and we probably should move in at 3613. And we'll get you out of here in 2 minutes. And just for the committee's sake, our committee administrator has been attending both of those work groups. So if you have additional questions or want to see notes on that, Beth is happy to brief you on that as well.
And thanks to Beth for, she's been very helpful in moving those work groups forward. So House Bill 3613, that was motivated by concerns. The work group on that stems from concerns that water quality standards adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission and administered by Department of Environmental Quality would result in requirements for farmers and ranchers that would be impossible to meet and would in turn be used to try to shut down particular operations. And so this generally relates to the roles of Oregon Department of Agriculture as well as Department of Environmental Quality around non-point source pollution. So the 3613 work group has talked through how Oregon's water quality standards are being implemented, and they've done so in some significant detail. And the group is providing initial input to DEQ and Department of Agriculture around an updated memorandum of agreement between the agencies. There appears to be a high level of agreement around working on this MOA, and the work group is comprised of the Farm Bureau, the Cattlemen's Association, the Oregon Environmental Council, Northwest Environmental Defense Center, and then staff, including the directors of Department of Ag, DEQ, and Department of Justice. So there are others involved in the work group as well who I didn't mention, but it's the point is that it's a diverse group of ag interests, non-point source pollution interests, as well as environmental interests. And the governor's made it clear that in this work group, he is not going to support legislation that weakens Oregon's water quality standards or that weakens Oregon Department of Agriculture's agricultural water quality management program. He is willing to, and the group is willing to, or looking to continue to advance this. He's willing to explore whether state statutes can be amended to clarify how Department of Ag and how Department of Environmental Quality work together around non-point source pollution. The groups also identify the importance of scientific data and getting at the overall effectiveness of the Ag Water Quality Management Program and non-point source pollution. So looking at the effectiveness of how projects on ag lands are addressing the programmatic issue of reducing non-point source pollution is something that the group's been discussing and that the governor's office feels is a real priority. And the recent funding package for Oregon Department of Ag to improve its ability to evaluate the programmatic effectiveness of the non-point source program is really key in this area. So the work group's met twice. We have one additional meeting scheduled, and that will focus on whether consensus can be reached on the memorandum of agreement between the agencies as well as potential legislative clarifications.
Okay. Any quick questions before we send Brett on his way on this? Okay, thanks for being here. You may be late. You can blame it on us, which they'll do anyway. So.
Thank you, Senator.
Watch out for Coburg. That's all.
Yeah, he knows. We will be following up at our next committee hearing, I'm sure, on many of these same topics. So appreciate you coming here today.
Thank you, Senator and Senators. I'm happy to, and I'm happy to report back whenever called upon.
Okay.
So I appreciate the invitation, and thank you. Thanks for getting me out.
You will be. So thank you. Drive safely.
Time. Thanks.
Or if you drive too fast, you'll just help fund our schools and police and everything else.
I'll post 202.
Yeah, you're giving away your tips to everybody listening, Senator Brzozinski. So
that's right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. We'll call back up the Elliott Forest panel, and we were about to have some questions posed by Senator Brzozinski. Okay. Senator?
So, Mike, I think maybe these questions are going to go to you or to Doug. I was looking at the cover letter that Doug signed that came on the handout that we got today. And based on your presentation, I understand that in the Elliott, 10% of the forest is under the forest, the Board of Forestry, and then the other 90% of the land. Is it a commingled 10%, or is there a set aside that this 10% is forest versus state lands?
Madam Chair, Senator Prusansky, it's kind of an artifact of history. It's a block. It's about a 9,500-acre block that's together. It's surrounded by Common School Fund-owned land.
Our own little ONC.
Yeah.
Pardon? Our own little ONC checkerboard.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. I suppose, sure. In a way.
Could you just state your name
sure.
for the record again,
Sorry
please.
About that. For the record, my name is Doug Decker, Oregon State Forester. Right, so it's those lands were blocked up from about 1914 until about 1930, and there has been discussions. In other words, there were lands that were exchanged to create the Elliott State Forest and make that one single block of Common School forest land. There have been discussions in the past about ways in which we can simplify, the ownership pattern there with having those become all Common School Fund lands and have the Board of Forestry own lands, which are largely in Northwest Oregon, the Tillamook, the Clatsop, and do some clarifying there. There are issues in terms of land exchanges associated with going across multiple counties that make that complicated, but that's the nature of that land base.
In the next paragraph at the end, it says harvest will occur about 1% of the forest acreage each year.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what that means? I mean, since I understand 1% of the whole, but are we talking about designating certain areas that will be worked based on whatever the variables may be, or?
Right. So we have annual operations plans, which are tiered to implementation plans. So on a kind of on a year-to-year basis, we know where we're going to be operating, and that is kind of consistent with the overall forest management plan that's been adopted. So at the 1% level, it basically is we plan well in advance. Our timber sales are planned well in advance in terms of surveys that need to be done a couple of years out, and so that 1% represents that annual share of working to address that implementation plan.
Okay. So one of the issues right now, knowing our economics are down, demand for lumber is down, the value of our land holdings are down in the sense of trying to sell. And hearing that what we're trying to do with the revisions on the Elliott is to increase more revenue, it almost seems like if the timber is valued less, aren't we going to have to sell more off to get these new levels of revenue that we're talking about? And that seems to me that it runs contrary from what we have been talking about sustainable and making certain that variable of demand versus supply is, balanced.
Do you think that? I've heard Louise talk.
Yeah, for the record, Mike Caffaretta, Deputy Chief of the State Forest Division, and Madam Chair, Senator Prusansky. The way we do our forest management plans is around sustainable harvest of volume, and so we do all of our modeling to make sure that 40 million board feet that we expect to get is sustainable over time, year in, year out. And the revenue that comes from that, which we want to be high levels of revenue, but it does fluctuate based on today's timber prices. And so by having our forest management plan use volume as what we look for sustainability on, that way we make sure even in years when the revenue is low, we're not increasing the harvest to try and achieve a revenue target.
Okay, thank you. I just want to get that on the record because I think a lot of people, I've heard from a number of people, let's call it both sides or three sides of the issue. And so I know that some people thought that meant there's more cut just to get that volume, that level of revenue. The other thing that was brought to my attention is, I guess I'm going to call it what, and I don't know if this is the correct term, but in your attachment 2 on the Elliott, it talks, we're talking about how the logs will be milled at local mills. Mm-hmm. And the concern is also that under state law and federal law that those logs can't be exported as raw logs. But someone's brought to my attention that there has been at least a practice of cutting something longer in length and then cutting the butt off to the point of where it can get commingled Can you tell me, I'm not sure if I fully appreciate what was brought to me, but I said that next time I had an opportunity, I would raise that question as to how do we maintain the integrity that those public logs are going to be going to local mills for jobs here in the U.S.
Right. Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Prusansky, I can't speak to the exact concern that your member has there. I can say that we have a lot of concern around that. A lot of our revenue comes from logs, and we have a very tight system to make sure that we receive that revenue and those logs are harvested appropriately and transported appropriately and milled at local mills. We employ two log accountability specialists, and their job is to watch that chain happen. We have a system in place where when they harvest a log and it gets put on a log truck, it gets a tag put on it, and that log truck goes and gets scaled and then gets delivered to that mill. And we have the next day we know where that load went and what it was scaled at, so we have ability to follow up and look at that. I will add that a lot of folks share that concern, and we get periodic complaints that concern about commingling, or this log yard is exporting off one side and your logs are coming in the other side. And so we follow up on all those complaints and make sure that that is not indeed happening, a commingling.
Louise, you want to add something?
Yeah, Louise Salve, Director of State Lands, Madam Chair, and Senator Prusansky. One other thing to point out is not only will we not sell to mills who, not only can logs coming off of state lands not be exported, we don't sell to companies that export to prevent substitution from occurring.
Okay. Thank you for your clarifications. Hope my constituents heard everything.
All right, we share that concern.
No.
Okay, other questions for panel? Senator Thompson.
On the 1% cut thing, is in Hood River County, we kind of term it we cut on a 80-year rotation. So what would your rotation be at 1%?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Thompson. We don't usually think completely in rotations. We're managing around maintaining a certain amount of habitat and then working on the rest of the landscape to maximize the revenue that we can. I think, though, the sort of analogous is probably in the 80-year. You know, it's about 90,000 acres. We're cutting about 850 acres a year. We have some conservation areas and stuff that don't figure into that equation. So it's somewhere in that 60 to 80-year range would be the long term.
I just wanted to follow up.
Sure.
Earlier in the presentation, you talked about, the age of the logs, and Senator Thompson made me think about this, that what age are we calling, I'm going to call it old growth or aging growth, that you said were set aside that would not be within this process for cut?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Prusansky, we would generally think about old growth being really large, old trees that are so most of the forest was regenerated after a fire in 1868.
Right.
We call those second growth. They're tight grown. They're large logs, but they're not the big old growth trees we think of. You know, old growth, we usually think of having a variety of characteristics beyond age, but generally in the 200 to 300-year range where they're really significantly larger trees and a different type of forest environment than the second growth.
Okay, trees. Clarification. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So basically, whatever, let's say, was impacted by the fire in the sense of would be potential for being within the base for cut.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, that's correct.
I have a question.
Yeah. And Senator Olson has a question, and then I think we're ready to move on to our next topic.
On your 28,000 acre set aside for a conservation area, are there any plans to go in and selectively thin that forest using new technologies, or do we just let it stay dormant and do its thing?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, you know, for the most part, we're managing those areas to further the benefits that, you know, species need. So, spotted owls and marbled murrelets in the short term probably don't need a lot of enhancement, although we would consider that if ever needed to. In our younger forests where we have murrelets in the North Coast, occasionally we do some active management there to maintain the characteristics or further develop those characteristics. On the Elliott, we might do some partial harvesting if it's consistent with the goals of those areas. It'd be probably a lower scale.
But you don't preclude the fact that you would not do it?
That's correct.
All right, thank you.
And Chair's prerogative, I have one last question for either, for any of you on the panel, but this has to do with the chart on, it doesn't have a page number on it, but, or page 12, I'm sorry, the comparisons between the 2011 and 1995 Elliott State Forest Management Plan. And I think Louise Soliday had mentioned this, or maybe it was maybe it was you, Mike, about the carbon sequestration, and I see that it's listed in there. Do we have any monetary value attached to that at this point, or saying this is potential? I mean, I'm assuming that there's no, I see that there's an EcoTrust study that had been done. So do we have any sense as what the potential value is for that sequestration services?
So, Madam Chair, the carbon market is in flux, to say the least, and it has actually been in a downward spiral in the past year or so. I've heard numbers of $10 a metric ton as a potential buy. We've done some analysis around what we get, try to compare that to harvest. And if we were going to get something equivalent to what we get for harvesting, the price of carbon would need to be up over $100 a metric ton. And, I don't think we're going to see that anytime soon. If there's ever a federal cap and trade program, that may change the market dynamics. California is putting in their cap and trade program is just going into effect. There may be some residual benefit that's going to come here as a result of that. That's yet to be seen. We did look at the California protocols, the CAR, what are called the CAR protocols, a little over a year ago for the Elliott to sort of see what it might mean. And our problem in the Elliott is we've been managing for older forests in the Elliott, and so the additionality we could get from changing management is pretty small and, in fact, may not exist at all. And that's what the carbon market currently is buying. As I explained to the board, it's a little perverse for me. Those who manage their forest the best get the least reward in the carbon market. So we're sitting with a forest that's an older forest is already storing huge volume of carbon, which is what the EcoTrust report did an analysis of. And so finding that additionality that somebody might actually pay for is pretty difficult.
Doug, do you want to follow up on this? Broaden the geographic perspective, one of the things we are looking at on the Gilchrist State Forest, which are very different lands, lands that have been harvested, that have not been in public ownership, we are looking at the potential to have carbon sequestration in the carbon market provide some level of revenue stream there. So, and that is a different flavor of state forest land. That's the Board of Forestry owned lands. Just a different land base. Right.
So, but what I'm hearing is if the landscape does change, I mean, that's based on today's regulatory framework or whatever you want to say. I mean, there could be, right, there could be some potential and possibly some ways to reward the management system that we have in place for those values that really are not, right now, highly, they're not monetarily valued on the market, so to speak. So I think that's an interesting one that we'll need to be continuing to watch. So why don't you go ahead, and then we'll switch over to water.
And this is in conjunction with Senator Pruszynski's comments on export logs. How many times do you sell those carbon credits that we have? If you have a forest and someone wants to come in and purchase carbon credits, how many people, how many different folks do you sell it to, or do you don't, are you limited to you can only sell to so many people, or you only have so many credits to sell?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I believe that they're done on, it's kind of like a lease, and you would do it for a particular vintage of a particular number of years, whatever your agreement would be.
Okay.
You would be agreeing to produce X number of metric tons per whatever that time frame. Typically, it's a year or a 10-year period.
So you don't sell the same forest 20 times?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the presentation. Again, I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this in February, if not before then. And thank you, Ms. Soliday, for jumping in as well. Okay, next up, we're going to switch gears a little bit to hearing an update on the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. I think we have Brenda Bateman. I don't think Phil can make it this morning, the director, so she's going to provide us with an update. I'm going to hand this to you while I take a break and be right back. Don't hit her on the head with that.
Who's bringing the beer?
We're a jerk.
Should be up there. I think we can in there.
I'll go ahead without it. Okay. Good morning, committee members. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Oregon Water Resources Department. Thank you for the invitation this morning to bring you updates on the state's integrated water resources strategy. I bring to you a couple of process updates and also content updates. And shortly, I think you'll be receiving a piece of paper that folds out about to this size, and I'll also have it hopefully appear on the screen. But I just wanted to bring you some of the updates that we've been having with conversations with our advisory groups and with the public. We are getting very close to publication or adoption deadline in the summer of 2012, and so I wanted to bring you those updates. See. It's always good to revisit just however briefly the origins of this work. And so if you'll think back to 2009, there was a House Bill 3369 that directed the Water Resources Department to lead efforts to understand and meet Oregon's water needs. And it bears repeating, we still have some confusion around this topic, that the scope of this project is water writ large for the state. So it goes beyond Water Resource Department's portfolio. We focus primarily on water quantity. This project is supposed to be looking at our water quantity needs as well as our water quality needs and our ecosystem needs for the state. And not only looking at today, but at the coming pressures that we may see with changes related to climate, land use, and population. Those are specifically called out in House Bill 3369. In order to accomplish this, obviously, we've brought in other departments from the state level. So we have our water quality experts, our fish and wildlife experts, our agricultural and economic development experts. And we've brought in not only tribes, stakeholders, and the public, but other levels of government as well. Some of these things may best be implemented, as you can well imagine, at the local level or maybe even the federal level. And so we really have a very broad conversation going on here. Water Resources Department is serving as the project manager for this and largely the scribe for the project, but in fact the discussion is much more broad beyond the scope of our agency. Where we are today, we've passed the midway point and we're shooting for adoption of the strategy this summer, so a little bit more on the timeline later in this presentation. What I really wanted to bring to you today was some updates on where our advisory groups are with this project. You may recall that we have three layers or three sets of advisory groups. We've brought in all of the natural resource agencies and economic development agencies at the state level. And so many of the folks who are here in the room today have been very valuable partners in terms of bringing in any of the maps, graphs, statistics, and background information that you're seeing as part of this project. And the scope, as I said, is very broad, ranging from public health to ecosystem health, water quality, water allocation, and beyond. On the federal side, we have a series or a set of 10 partners who are involved in land management and water management, and these folks have also been very valuable in our efforts. They're currently serving as peer reviewers for much of the writing that's going on, particularly with the focus on technologies and techniques. You know, there are many things that Oregon is a leader in today when it comes to water management, groundwater storage techniques, canal piping and lining, soil moisture sensing, and many techniques and technologies that our federal agencies have said, we'll help you peer review some of those write-ups, make sure they're understandable and that they're in the proper context. So we've very much appreciated their help. But mostly I wanted to focus on the role of our policy advisory group, which has been meeting on a quarterly basis, is comprised of 18 citizen members. I think you probably know many of them. They come from very diverse perspectives and very diverse geographies. And I'll tell you, the first couple meetings there were, well, I was going to say they were heartbreakers, mostly for me. Some pretty rough going with very different perspectives and very different goals from each member of this group. But in the last couple of meetings, I've had this feeling that the group has really pulled together, that there's a level of trust there, not only amongst each other, but with them and the staff.
that they've really given us leeway to go back and try again when there's something that makes them uncomfortable or a policy that's not fully fleshed out. They've been very patient with us and very trusting, I think, of the project team and staff, and saying, here are my concerns, here are some sideboards I'd like to see, can you go back and try it again? And because that process has been very robust and thoughtful, I think we are really coming closer to the product that we were all hoping to see next summer. They've helped us a lot with the wordsmithing and with some policy suggestions and ideas, and that's been incredibly valuable. Identifying the critical issues was really one of our midpoint stages, happened in 2010, and this was when we went out and met with stakeholder groups, the tribes, conducted 11 open houses and one virtual open house online, and really gathered from folks the challenges they felt they were facing first and foremost in their communities related to water. And after we'd gathered all that information, we put together this sort of at a glance, which hopefully you have at your places by now. I've been calling it the placemat because of its size. And we just wanted to run through a little bit how this has been shaping up. The paper that you have in front of you is a slightly older version. It should be dated June 23rd. And since then, we've had several policy advisory group meetings that have evolved these ideas even further. So what you have in front of you isn't the latest and greatest. We're expecting that in December. But it's what we have for now, and I'll highlight some of the things that are on there and some of the changes that have been suggested in our advisory group meetings. If you look at this paper in front of you, the top left quadrant that's up here is really a focus on understanding our water resource, the physical water resource, and also our water institutions. So some of the conversations that we've been having in this area are along the lines of, can we better map our water-related institutions? We have a lot. If we look at local, state, federal level, and throw in some of our private partners too, there's a lot going on. Is there some way that we can better describe this so the public has some idea where to turn when they have questions? Can we better map our permitting processes, or perhaps look at streamlining those and improving them even further? So those are some of the discussions there, as well as some very data-focused discussions. Do we have the right observation networks in place? Are we processing and sharing data robustly and in a timely manner? I think the answer is no, so there's some work there to be done. How can we better coordinate with folks who are in the field, and how could we be sharing information even better? And how could we be developing tools so that we can run scenarios, ask what-if questions of ourselves? So all of that data-related information can be found in that quadrant. Moving across the page, there's more data-related questions, but this has to do with water demands and water needs. So this is where you'll find work around a long-term water forecast, improving our water use measurement, getting those water right adjudications completed, as some of them even started at this point. And then in-stream, better understanding the flows that are needed to support some of our in-stream functions, and better understanding our groundwater-dependent ecosystems. So if you're looking for demand and need type of information, that's where that's found in the project. And I will just say at this point that this is an at-a-glance paper. There are many more details and text and narrative available on our website to back all of this up. The third quadrant, bottom left, is really a look at the future that the legislation had called out. So here's where you'll find some of the emerging issues, in as an example, the water-energy nexus. And better understanding that comes here. You know, we have a lot of energy policy and a lot of energy development that we're thinking of, and the sort of question that comes along with that is, what are the impacts going to be on water demand as a result? So those types of questions reside there. This is also where our climate change piece is. We all know that there's some interesting data available at the global level. What is that going to mean for us locally? A lot of that is still in the process of being downscaled, and our technical scientists are helping with that. And the bill specifically calls out the need for helping water users adapt and helping the ecosystem maintain some resiliency in the face of climate change. And so that work resides there. Finally, in this box, we have some water land use questions. Are we getting the right water data into the hands of planners and permit writers so that they have the information that they need to make decisions? And finally, there's an infrastructure piece there. This is always where the huge price tag pops up when you talk about water and wastewater-related infrastructure. We have a lot of work to do in this area, not only to maintain what we have, but to build and be creative in the future. So that's where you'll find a lot of our price tag for this project. Finally, in the last quadrant of this page, you'll see many of the more tangible and traditional types of projects that you'd expect to see in a state water plan. So here is where we have some discussions about education and training. We're watching with some alarm the impending retirement of some of our water and wastewater certified treatment operators, and looking at some of the training programs that seem to be waning in this economy. And so there are questions and recommendations there about further technical training and education that's needed. Funding, of course, is ever present. And in this section, we are talking about not only funding continued development of the strategy, but also some of our core agency responsibilities, and funding communities who have good ideas of their own and are working on water resource projects and need funding for those. Issue number 10 that's there on your page has to do with place-based approaches. And I really feel personally that this is going to be probably the cornerstone of the strategy. And so I'll just pause here for a moment. There's quite a bit of interest in a local approach to planning. I think you're probably aware of previous attempts or previous activities in water planning in the state that were centrally driven, top-down, pretty prescriptive, and were not necessarily very popular as a result. One of the things we heard as we were gearing up for this project was we need more grassroots, bottom-up, regionally led discussions where we know what our challenges are and we know what our resources are. So there's a piece in here about regional water planning and trying to set some sideboards for what kinds of questions should be asked, who should be at the table, and what kind of assistance the state could provide in terms of funding, technical assistance, sideboards, technologies, things like that. So this is really increasing as a pillar in the strategy, and you'll start to see that it's then tied back to everything else that's in here. How can we get the right data to communities? How can we get them the right funding, technical assistance, etc.? Number 11 is probably where you'll find the most traditional types of projects that you might be looking for in a state plan. So here's where we have conversations about water conservation and efficiency, water storage, and reuse projects. Those all reside there. And finally, pretty importantly, we have our public health, ecosystem, and water quality pieces, which are all very closely tied together, and so we've put them all in one group for now. But this is where you'll find recommendations dealing with drinking water safety, toxics, natural storage, in-stream protections, water quality, and more. So I'll just leave that there for a moment and take any questions. I know it's an awful lot, and hopefully some of our partners have remained in the room in case you have questions that stray into those areas as well.
We'll see if there's any questions, but then and are you going to talk about the next steps and where we go? Because that's where most of my questions center around. But we'll see if there's any questions now from committee. Okay, I keep going.
Next steps in the strategy. The next benchmark that folks should be looking for is December, which feels like tomorrow. Then we'll have a discussion draft
available. Yes.
So this will be the full draft. What you've seen from our project before has been bits and pieces, very narrow slices of the project. This, for the first time, will pull together everything in one place. You know, why we're doing this, what we expect to get out of it, recommended actions. So you can look for that in December. And then in the first quarter of next year, our Water Resources Commission will be gearing up for adoption. Before they adopt the strategy, though, they're required by the legislation to notify and consult with other boards and commissions. So they'll be taking the December draft around and having conversations with each of the boards and commissions that are involved and getting their comment, making sure that their needs are well reflected in here as well. We'll continue to take public comment through mid-March, and then we're aiming for an August 2nd adoption of the strategy by the Water Resources Commission. Some folks feel like that's the end stage, but in our minds, that's really just the beginning. From there, we'll be launching into much more detail to take into the 2013 legislative session. So that's where you'll start to see more complete work plans with timelines, price tags, FTE, staffing requirements and things like that. We're very sensitive, of course, to the economic realities and know that we'll probably only be able to carry forward a couple of things from this strategy. But our intent is to use this as a long-term blueprint. These are things that we really need to address and pay attention to. And if we can't get some of this done in the 2013 session, we'll bring back the ideas and requests into subsequent sessions after that. The legislation also asks us to update this plan every 5 years, so we have time to add more detail, to grow into it, and to evolve as we need to. Just a reminder, I think maybe some of your constituents might continue to ask how they can be involved in the strategy, and so we have a web page that's hosted by the Water Resources Department, and from there you can sign up to a listserv, get additional information and materials, and in particular be notified of the December draft when it's ready to go. We would love to have continued comment and input, because we want to make this product as good as it can be before the August adoption, and so we would welcome your thoughts and suggestions as we go. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. One thing I will note before we move on to questions is that, again, our committee staff, Beth Petrino, has been attending all those meetings and taking notes. So if you, I mean, I received those notes. If you're interested, please contact her, because there's a lot of good discussions that are going on there. We'll see if there's any questions before I launch on mine. No? Any questions for Brenda? Okay. A couple things, Brenda. I guess as far as next steps, how do we get, I guess what I see is next steps would be a prioritization process, because we have a lot of recommended actions. So can you talk a little bit about that, and then how we get from there to an actual implementation plan?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you for bringing that up. You might notice on your at-a-glance paper, and like I say, we're still playing with this as a slightly older version, but what you'll see on here are some symbols and icons that should help us with making this not quite so overwhelming. And so one of the things that's on here is a key. And our intent here is really to mark the requirements that were mentioned in House Bill 3369. That was sort of our first go at this. Things that have keys on here are things that are really absolutely required under the legislation, and will probably be the next steps or the first steps that we take in the next 5 years. So you're likely to see if there are any budget requests or legislative concepts that they would be probably most closely related to these keys. The other thing that's on here is a little symbol for a book. And so we've identified many places where we could use much more data and research to help with decision-making or decide future pathways. And that's not to say that the agencies necessarily have the capacity or ability to look into each of these items. We're actually hoping that this will serve as a signal to academic institutions, graduate students who are looking for projects and ideas, and other folks who are equipped to undertake some of this research and data analysis to help us get to the next stage in some of these items. So there are little books sprinkled throughout here. And the next step, as I mentioned, will be to start to pull together packages. Of course, we're working with the governor's office, our sibling agencies, and other partners to figure out what's realistic and what we could forward into the 2013 session.
Okay. A couple of comments, I guess. First of all, I want to commend you, Brenda, because I know you've been really the leader in this effort, and all the agencies and stakeholder groups that have been involved. I think given the tall order that you were delivered, you've been doing a very good job of the limited resources that you have. I will put out there sort of a cautionary note in that I'm hoping that we don't lose sight of what the task that we sent you off to do really focuses on. I guess integration is really the operative word. I mean, we are looking at a time of reduced resources, certainly the need to be creative and look at, as you already mentioned, more collaborative interjurisdictional and interorganizational relationships, I think, are going to be key to implementing many of the tasks that we're looking at here. And I think if we are just looking at extending the status quo, then basically, you know, we've failed, because the point of this exercise is really to think out of the box and look at some innovative approaches for managing our water resources and making sure that we really look at how we can chart a sustainable future without compromising protection of our resources and meeting our future needs. The concern that I have is with the budgetary constraints that we can't rely on just adding more FTEs or continuing programs the way that they've operated in the past. I think we really need to be creative and break down silos. You know, I know there's some legislative constraints, so certainly I'm hoping that there'll be some recommendations about how we may have to change legislation to provide more flexibility, if that's what it takes. So I'm looking forward to hearing about, as you work forward on that prioritization. I will encourage you to be as creative as possible. I think we're going to need to do that because, tomorrow we get, unfortunately, probably more bad news and doesn't bode well for just, looking at a whole continued along the course of just adding FTEs. I think we're going to have to look at how we can be creative in funding these solutions. So I'm looking forward to hearing the ideas that come forward to that.
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair.
Yep.
I have a question.
Sure.
Ma'am, on 11D, you say assist in the development of ecosystem credits and markets. Are we creating a new market, or is this currently in effect now?
Madam Chair, Senator, this is really an emerging topic for us in Oregon. The focus at this point in this section is on partnerships and protocols that are in development now. And so we're really heavily focused on the work of the Willamette Partnership, the Freshwater Trust, Clean Water Services, DEQ, and other folks who have been looking specifically at meeting water quality requirements through shading and other techniques and trying to figure out how to make that work. That's really the first step, and I think where the emphasis is in Oregon. From there, I think the conversation will progress. But I think baby steps and working with partners who have already been engaged in this for several years now, right, is really the starting point for this.
Yeah, and Senator, there was a bill that was passed 2009 session,
yeah,
to help jumpstart that and fund an ecosystem services approach, and that was funded partially on a lottery funds, OEB. And so I know that that's ongoing. And I think there was legislation last session, and my sense is we'll probably see more in the future. But it's been initiated. So I think we're talking about building upon those efforts.
That's right.
Other questions? Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brenda.
See you later. Okay, moving along, and we have two more issues. We have a report from the Department of Environmental Quality on the paint stewardship program. We have Palmer and Abby and whoever else is coming up from DEQ, okay? And you probably recall we had a brief update from Palmer last time, and now we're going to hear recommendations from a more full assessment of the paint stewardship program. Hey, Palmer, why don't you go ahead and get started where we're getting our IT up and running.
All right. So good morning. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality, and I have with me Abby Borderis of our solid waste staff and who oversees the paint stewardship program at DEQ. We're here to talk to you today about our legislative report, which was based on legislation passed in 2009. House Bill 3037 set out to create the first in the nation statewide product stewardship program to manage leftover paint. And one of the requirements in that legislation was for DEQ to come back to the legislature and report on the program. And specifically, we were asked to answer the question of whether this pilot program, and we've only had the first year of a four-year pilot program, whether this pilot program should be made permanent, and if it were to be made permanent, what type of changes would be made to the program to ensure that it ran effectively and efficiently. And so that's what we've done. We've done an analysis, and we have some recommendations that Abby will take you through. So thank you.
So thank you very much. Welcome. For the record, I'm Abby Borderis from the Oregon DEQ. I'm a solid waste policy analyst. And thank you for having us here to talk about the paint program and the report today. I look forward to sharing our recommendations with you. So just to take a step back before we dig into all the details, is just wanted to give you a little bit of background on PAINT and the program so that you understand the context of the recommendations. So why PAINT? Leftover PAINT is the largest component of what gets collected in household hazardous waste collection programs. So those are typically local government and local solid waste hauler programs around the state. An estimated 10% of all PAINT that gets sold is left over. So it's a very large volume material, and it's difficult to manage. But it can be recovered and recycled, but it requires public awareness and a convenient and effective collection system and a financing mechanism. So building on national discussions, which have gone back, almost 10 years now, DEQ, local governments, and the paint industry came together to pass that paint law in 2009. And it was a paint product stewardship law, and I think you guys have heard about product stewardship over time and e-waste and the like, but it is an approach where all parties involved in the whole life cycle of a product, design, production, sale, use, disposal, get together to minimize the impact of that product. The law passed, 3037 House Bill, in 2009, and notably, I just want to remind, it was the first in the country. Everyone is watching, and it was intended to be a pilot and a demonstration for other states to look at and learn from. The program launched in July of 2010, so really just 1 year ago, and it is set to sunset in 2014. So how does it work? A nonprofit organization, Paint Care, was established by the American Coatings Association, representing the paint industry. And what they needed to do and did was develop a plan and submit it to DEQ on how to do education, outreach, and collection of the leftover paint. Consumers pay through a per-container fee on paint when they buy it. That's how it's funded. The industry submits a plan to DEQ. It's reviewed and approved. So that's how we have our oversight role of the program. And manufacturers and retailers cannot sell paint into Oregon unless they have an approved plan. Retailers have a requirement to provide information to consumers about how to get rid of their paint. So first, I'm going to very briefly, and there's a lot more detail in the report that you guys have access to, go over just some of the overall findings of the report, and then we really use that information to come up with the recommendations. So first of all, the program resulted in the collection of about 460,000, a little more than that, gallons of leftover paint in Oregon. And while that was not a large increase from what was collected previously, although it was an increase, there are another number of other outcomes that really are setting up the program for future success. First of all, the number of collection sites increased dramatically from really just a couple dozen local programs to over 90 sites as of when the report was written, actually, and now they're close to 100 now. And that's a combination of retailers that volunteered to be part of the program and the household hazardous waste collection programs that were collecting it already. There was a pretty good recycling rate for the latex paint that was collected, 57% as of when the first year of the program happened, and that's actually increased since then. Perhaps one of the most significant outcomes of the program or findings is the savings by local governments who have been collecting paint at great cost for a long time. For example, Metro has reported saving over $1 million in the first year alone. They represent the largest program, so have the largest savings, but there are many other collection programs around the state, and they have saved money. So the cost of managing this material has shifted from the local government, local programs, to the people who purchased the paint in the first place. A few more findings before we get to the recommendations. And very importantly, we didn't have a lot of data about how much paint was actually sold in Oregon, collection, et cetera. So now that we have 1 year of the program, or I should say Paint Care does, under our belts, we know a lot more information about the amount of paint sold, the amount available for collection, recovery rates that can be achieved, and all of this can be used for looking forward to that permanent program and is actually being very actively used by other states. This law has actually since passed in California and Connecticut with bills pending in a lot of states. So the information is being used by many. Paint Care did a survey, and they found that Oregonians really did value this program. 92% of recent paint purchasers, so those are the people who are really impacted by the both the cost and the benefit of the program, or found that the program was either very important or somewhat important. So what the rest of what we'll talk about and what the report does was look at what we saw in the program and, like the legislation requires, look for ways to improve and move forward. And that's what I'll move on to now. So we have a series of recommendations, and the recommendations didn't just come from DEQ, actually. We had our analysis. There was an EPA evaluation that was done outside of our work, and we had a stakeholder process. We published a draft report. We had some stakeholder meetings and took comment in October and incorporated that information in the recommendations that we've made. What we are recommending is that the program does be made permanent, hopefully before it sunsets in 2014, but very importantly, that not just a rubber stamp on the existing law as it was written. It was actually intentionally written generally to allow flexibility to run a pilot and to learn. And now we're learning, although we only have 1 year of data. We'll have another year come next September, which will be very helpful. So we have 8 considerations that I'm going to lay out that we would like to be considered in future legislation, as well as the data as it becomes available. So the first one is to improve collection convenience, and specifically for there to be a convenient standard. What you see in the picture on the map is a very generalized version of where the 95 sites are in Oregon. And there is pretty good coverage, but we feel that the language of the bill said that there needed to be convenient and available statewide collection of paint in urban and rural areas of the state. And what that actually proved was to be a little bit too vague and too general to come to a common understanding of where paint collection sites needed to be. So we recommend that there is a standard. And for those of you who are familiar with the electronics e-waste law, which I'm thinking you guys probably are, there is a set standard in there of one per county and one per population city size. And we recommend, while the paint one wouldn't fit exactly in that, but by following a model that is similar there, so that all consumers of paint in Oregon have a fair opportunity for managing their leftover paint. And we do recommend it be based on a county focus. It's the way a lot of solid waste work is done. So the next one, and what the graphic shows is how the assessment is rated. So if you have a gallon container of paint, you pay 75 cents. Up to 5 gallons, it's $1.60, and smaller for smaller amounts. And what we would, and that's intended to cover the full cost of the program. And as we interpret the statute, that's every cost from the collection point all the way through education and recycling and disposal of the paint as appropriate. Currently, what's the way the program is being implemented by Paint Care, it does not include payment to collectors of paint. So the local governments who are taking the paint from the consumer packaging it and sending it off are not being compensated. That is actually, they are compensated in electronics program, and we would like to see that come into alignment. So while local governments are saving a good bit of money now because they don't need to pay the management costs, there is an additional savings that we think they should be compensated for. In addition, DEQ's costs, there is a provision to provide oversight administrative costs to DEQ, and the way it was structured in the law does not cover our costs, so we'd like to make sure that is brought into alignment as well. So program measures, I think any good program actually has measures in it to ensure accountability, and I think that's the key. We very much agreed to let them not be in there in the pilot because we didn't know what they would be. So it didn't seem appropriate to put that in there at the time. But there are a number of areas that should have measures, we think, in the permanent program. One of the goals we didn't talk about yet is paint was never intended by the paint industry for it to go anywhere but on the wall. So it's an unintended leftover. And one of the goals of the law is to reduce that leftover paint. That's not easy, and it has not been successful yet in the first year of the program, but we'd like to see some measures around that. We'd like to see some goals or measures around the amount of paint that gets reused. So it gets turned in and it's still perfectly good. Find mechanisms to get it out there. Right now, Habitat for Humanity's ReStores are one of the big retail collection sites, and they have been the success story thus far in reuse. Quite a market, actually, for artists and other people and in down economic times to reuse paint. Measures around convenience, we talked about that a little bit. In collection volume, we'd like to see some measures around there to make sure that it's getting as much paint as is out there and is available for collection. I'd like to see measure around the recycling rate for paint. We obviously want to recycle as much of the latex paint that is recyclable and not see any unnecessarily going to landfill or other disposal. Consumer education. The program will only work if people know about it and either buy the right amount of paint or bring it in the end. And an ongoing continuous improvement, and particularly around the expenses of the program. We want to make sure that the paint care organization is driven to do it as cost-effectively as possible. It's being funded by paint consumers, the residents of Oregon. And then maybe not a hugely exciting one, but one is very important to us in providing oversight, is to amend some of the annual report requirements. The first one was requested by Paint Care. It's too soon. They have to the year ends in end of June, and then they have to have a report to us in September. It's just really not reasonable, and it actually was very difficult. Then we only got our information in September then to get to you. So to move that back another month or two. To require reporting on those measures that we just discussed, and then to require that changes that need to be made in the plan they submit to us are identified and regularly changed, and that they evaluate the effectiveness of the program. For example, if they're not getting a lot of paint in a county, in Coos County, for example, that they would be looking at why. Why isn't that working? What would they need to do to get more paint there? So an ongoing evaluation of that. A simple one that we originally excluded or did not intentionally include aerosol paint, spray paints, in the bill, mostly just because it was another moving piece to manage, and we feel like it should be explicitly included in the future program.
And what percentage of the waste stream is aerosols? I'm assuming it's a pretty small
percentage. It's pretty small. Yeah. It is. I don't have the exact number. And I think this is a small detail, but something that would be easy. We'd like to see specific strengthening and clarification in the education and outreach, specifically around targeted messages either to key demographic groups or to areas that aren't utilizing the program. So to be much more specific, you know, to Pancare's credit, they did a great startup year of getting out there, getting some radio ads, newspaper, et cetera. So we'd like to see it more targeted, though, in the future to constantly refine it, to focus on prevention and reuse and those areas with low collection volumes.
And Abby, are they providing, is Pancare providing this, the handout material to retailers?
Yes.
Because I know early on, when my husband went and bought paint and came back complaining to me about the new fee, there was no materials associated with that, and so I'm hoping that's been rectified.
And that's actually one of our recommendations, is that there's a little bit more clarity on who's responsible for that, but they have, Pancare has provided the information, whether they have complete saturation of that and how well they're keeping them supplied. I think they have a ways to go on that, because people have a right to know why they're being charged that fee.
And if I can add, Senator, there's also an obligation under the law for the retailers to provide this information. So that may be an issue that we have to look at to make sure retailers are fulfilling their end of the bargain.
Some oversight and process changes that need to happen, specifically around plan approval and reapproval for significant changes as it goes on. Right now we have a one multi-year plan because it was a pilot, but the plan and that interaction over the submittal approval is the key way that DEQ can provide its oversight of the program. We'd like to have more information specifically be required to be reported on the costs of the program, and that to be spelled out. Some clarity on violations and penalties. Most of it is now pegged to existing language in other statutes, and it would be more, it would be easier to use if it was specific to this program. And then some process, a process if Pancare wants to change the assessment, that per container cost, it's through the plan right now. We just want to make sure that that's very clear how they would change it in the future. If costs go up or go down, they may need to adjust that. And then finally, we recommend that before the program is made permanent, that DEQ consider and evaluate the funding mechanism. Right now, as you saw, it's what we call an eco fee or a per container fee charged at time of retail, and the law actually specifically says the price that costs must be actually paid by the manufacturers and passed down to the price of paint. It was very specific. There are other mechanisms to fund a product stewardship program. The way our other big product stewardship program is funded, the electronics program, is through an internalized cost. So the manufacturers internalize it, and then they figure out how to recoup their money. So we're just recommending that that's looked at before permanent legislation is written. So from there, we can take some questions.
Okay. Questions for the department? Senator? Mm-hmm. I'll encourage you, if you have not read through the full report, by the way, I will encourage you to
go ahead.
So.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Senator Hess.
I just had some questions, mostly just curiosity about the containers, paint containers, and what happens to those. In my garage, for example, I think there's more of that problem than actual paint.
So many of your containers are empty or almost empty. And actually, if it is empty, you can take the lid off and throw it in the trash. The hauler wants to know that it is empty. But many of the cans are recycled, and I know there's a lot of work going on there. It's difficult because of how messy they are. So that's been an ongoing effort by the service providers, the people who are managing the paint, which includes Metro, some other local governments, Lincoln County, Marion County, and Amazon Environmental, who get the paint. So a portion is recycled, and actually that's not reported on in the report, and it would be an excellent question for me to have the answer to, and I can get that.
So the right thing to do then, if you've got a mostly empty, dried up bucket of paint and an aluminum can, is to put it in your big sorting bin.
In your trash, yes.
Trash?
In your trash, not in your recycling.
Okay.
Follow-up question, though. Can those containers be taken to Metro, to the household hazardous waste collection area where they will be able to actually recycle them?
Absolutely. And Metro is one of the big collectors, the biggest single collector in this program. And so, yes, you can bring it to your household hazardous waste collection program to manage it. Some people just don't want to bring in empty containers. So if you want to be thorough, yes, bring it in.
I know that Senator House always wants to be thorough.
Well, I know that Metro actually has a program where they resell paint.
So,
do you work with them? I mean, how does that work with what you're doing?
Absolutely, Senator. The program, PaintCare, very actively included Metro in the program. So Metro serves many roles in this program. They are a collection site like they have been forever, so that you can bring all of your leftover chemicals, including paint, to them. They actually are under contract to PaintCare to be a recycler. They're the primary latex recycler. So all of the good latex paint in Oregon now goes to Metro, and they are paid by PaintCare to recycle it, and then that's the stuff you're seeing in the stores. So they've increased their volume tremendously. They really like the white paint, so everyone bring them their white paint. And they work with both Miller Paint and some other retailers to sell it. So, yes, that paint is this PaintCare program. And I think one of a good success of the program is that they used the local infrastructure rather than sending all of our paint out of state.
For the oil-based paints, the deck stains, what do you do with the oversupply of those?
They're sent for energy recovery. There's no current recycling.
So you don't bring those to these sites?
Well, all of it, all of that material, latex and oil-based paint and stains, all can be brought in. It's just that part, they can't recycle that.
Okay. Senator, good question. Senator Olson?
I do. Do you have any numbers on what was collected prior to this program,
paint-wise?
I do. We don't have great numbers for a few reasons. One is it wasn't something that DEQ collected. We do know that from the number we were able to get from 2008, it's about a 3% increase based on a pretty rough apples to oranges comparison. So there wasn't a standard metric that anyone was using. So we think we know about 3% more was collected, but we don't have good data until now. We have this baseline, so we'll know where to go forward.
Follow up.
So prior to the collection of the fee for the paint from the consumer, you collected 3% less than what you're collecting now, and the fee's been added. Is that what you're telling me?
That is correct, but who paid for it is what changed.
The government paid for it, which is essentially the taxpayer.
Before, right. and waste fees. A lot of local programs are actually paying it through their solid waste fees.
Hello? Next question, then. You've added a series of things that you needed to finance. Have you anticipated what the cost per your chart, what your cost for a quart or a pint or a gallon would run the consumer?
I actually don't anticipate a significant increase, if any, in the assessment that would be charged to the consumer. I think a lot of this is refining of what's going on now. The one recommendation that I think potentially would cost more is the paying the collection costs to local governments. And we have some idea of what that might be, and we actually expect to spend some time over the next year getting good information on what that would be. I think there's a lot of improvement for efficiencies that I think they could probably do practically all of this for the same amount.
And if I may, Chair Dingfelder and Senator Olson, add, what we expect, particularly if the legislature were to adopt these recommendations or similar recommendations, is over time we're going to see more efficiencies in the program. They had a high run-up in cost because it was just the first year of a four-year pilot. And like any operation, any enterprise, there's, you know, capital costs, startup costs, and over time you get efficiencies because you run your operation better, you learn from what we're doing. And then we're specifically recommending to the legislature that there be some mechanisms in place, like the program measures, to ensure that there's, you know, targets, and that those things, those targets, can drive accountability.
On the education program, and Palmer, you said that retailers fulfill their end of the bargain by providing documentation. Do they have to buy that documentation, or is it provided free of charge?
It is provided to them by PaintCare.
Okay. Follow-up? Mm-hmm. One thing that you said, you wanted to focus on areas of low collection rates. However, if people buy paint as they're supposed to and not have any left over, you would have low collection. Would that not be correct?
That's right, and that's the trick with any kind of prevention program, and that's why we would want to have a goal for or a measure around prevention and reuse as well as for collection, because you need to balance those out, because, yeah, we don't want to just have them sell so much they can collect so much.
And if I may add on that point, I mean, it wouldn't be, I think, appropriate not to take into account that if paint care and DEQ and the stakeholders are successful in reducing the generation of paint, that we have this really high bar in statute for collection. I mean, those two metrics are going to have to work in tandem. So that's a great point. And hopefully we'll have that problem where we're reducing the amount of paint. And the industry wants this, too, for people to buy the paint they need to do the job that they've set out to do and not anymore.
Phillips? You're in my expertise now, and sometimes it's difficult with the product that's applied to the material behind it as to whether you got the right amount or not the right amount. But the point, and I'm glad you made it, was the fact that I was concerned that as we have less collection, that we want to increase price to make certain that we collect more, and I wanted to make sure that cost shift wasn't, you know, because if you do this right, you will have very low collection rates.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's what we're after, and I don't want to see that price escalate to pay for because we don't have appropriate collection rates.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent questions. Any other questions for the department? Okay, well, thank you for the update. I have a feeling we're going to be hearing more, and to appreciate this preliminary results. I do believe also that as people find out more about the program, I think we're going to see similar effects to what we saw with the e-waste, where we had a lot of people, like Senator Hess, that's holding on to paint, don't know where to take it or what to do with it, and I think as more information becomes available, I think that we may see a greater influx. I don't know if you have estimates about how much paint is stored. You know, obviously Metro, we've had ongoing programs, but other parts of the state haven't had accessible programs necessarily to the same extent we've had in the Portland area.
I do have another question. When do you plan on legislation? I mean, do you want to extend the sunset, but I mean, do you want that done next session, 2013, or do you want it done a little farther out so you can get more data?
So, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, that's a great question. I don't have a complete answer to that because right now the department is in the process of deciding what our legislative concepts would be, the bills we would introduce in the 2013 session. And let me say this first. We're definitely not talking about anything in the 2012 session.
Okay.
So I should have probably started with that. So, yes, we are talking about the 2013 session, and I'm not sure whether the department would come to the legislature with a bill or whether the industry would do that or they would have a bill and we would have a bill. That hasn't been worked out yet, but we were definitely talking about the 2013 session. And as you are alluding to, we will benefit from having a second year's worth of data and more discussions with the stakeholders and with the paint industry about some of these recommendations that we've laid out.
Yeah, I think Senator Olson raises an excellent point. It sounds like, you know, the more data we have, then we can refine these recommendations. And so I think that would be very helpful. So stay tuned.
Just be on record that I will be watching your funding mechanism.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here today. And we'll look forward to updates on a regular basis. And with that, we have one more presentation on our agenda. So we're going to end with a very interesting topic that the chair requested This is an issue around fracking. It's been in the news quite a bit lately. If you don't know what it is, you are about to learn. And I've asked the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries to come forward and just sort of give us a fracking 101. And there'll be a quiz at the end. So, but
I'm an oil and gas person.
We are going to have to be brief. If there's additional information that we need follow up, there's nothing obviously pending right now. So we will. If there's additional information for follow up, we can have you back in January in the February session.
Probably should bring some boys up from Texas.
I'm sure there'd be some folks from Texas happy to come here and talk about this, but today we just have the department that's going to provide us with what is fracking? Is it happening here in Oregon? If so, where? And why should we be, knowledgeable about this issue?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Chair Dan Kelder, members of the committee, my name is Gary Lynch, and really my only function today is to introduce Bob. We do regulate oil, gas, geothermal, and mining in the state. While there's not a lot of oil and gas going on, there is some. Bob will explain that for us. Understand we do this with a half an FTE, and that requires that we have been working closely with both DEQ and Water Resources, and we will continue to do that and to maintain our presence in regulating the industry. With that, I'll let Bob introduce himself.
Chair Dingfelder, my name is Bob Houston with the Oregon Department of Geology. I'm a petroleum geothermal geologist. And so, really quick, this is the what, the where, the how of hydrofracturing, and it's a summary of a letter at the request of Bence, response to him, Representative Bence, and this presentation summarizes that. So let's just jump into it. But really quick, so this is the oil and gas program. This is where we currently have active permits in the state, which are about 104. 82 of those are located in the Mist Gas Field in Northwest Oregon, located right up here. Of those, 30 are currently producing, and that's a gas field that was identified in 1980 and has been producing gas ever since that time. Around about 2003, we had a spike of activity in permitting for coal bed methane, and those occurred down around the Coos Bay Basin. And I'll touch upon those. Some of those wells, about five of them, were actually hydrofractured at that time. And we'll talk about that as a good example of who has authority, what the permitting process is, and what was all related to that. And that serves as a model for how we'll deal with a proposal for hydrofracturing in the future. But really, what spurred all the questions of Representative Bence in Idaho, in New Plymouth, which is about 5 miles east of the border, Bridge Resources drilled about 11 wells and found economic quantities of gas. It's the first time they ever found gas in Idaho. They went back to Idaho's Department of State Lands and asked to hydrofracture four of those, which Idaho was drafting rules in. I think they approved them yesterday. So that spurred a lot of questions of what could be the potential impacts to Oregon. So let's talk historically. About 27 wells were drilled in the Vail, Ontario area, and the last one being drilled in the mid-50s. At that time, they were looking for oil. The infrastructure in the U.S. was not able to handle natural gas. It was mostly looking for oil. Those wells did find gas, but shows of gas, not economic quantities, and definitely they didn't find any oil. So those wells were plugged and decommissioned at that time, and since that time, no further wells have been drilled for exploration for oil and gas resources. So what is hydrofracturing? And it's a technique recently developed within the last 20 years, I guess. And it's a technique used to increase the permeability and porosity of the reservoir rock, which are typically coal beds or shales, in order to increase the rate of recovery to economic levels. So the picture on the left is a picture of a shale bed in Canada in outcrop. But this is a good example of what shales would look like at depth when you drill into them. Shale is basically mudstone that was deposited in a deep marine environment, precipitated organics and mudstones laid down in horizontal beds. And with time, burial, and increased pressure and temperature, those organics maturate into hydrocarbons. So when a well is drilled down into the shale sequence, the new drilling technology of subhorizontal allows them to follow these sediments parallel to bedding for quite some distance. Because the shale is so, permeability and porosity is so low in those shales, it doesn't give up the gas at economic levels. So you need to open up pathways or fractures in which the gas can go from the rock into the wellbore. So if you drill a well without hydrofracturing, there are existing fractures in the rock that connect all those layers together, and that really doesn't produce gas at economic qualities. And there's large deposits of that throughout the nation that was not being able to utilize without hydrofracturing. So what they do is they pressure up, they pump a fluid, which is called a hydrofracturing fluid, and I'll describe what that is. But they pressure up, they pump that down the well, and they increase pressure on that to a point that that pressure starts to exceed the fracture pressure of the rock. They start to propagate the fracture laterally from the well, and that is shown in this sequence here. And if you do that enough time, now you're increasing the permeability and porosity of that rock, opening up more pathways which the gas can go into the wellbore and making it more economic. So what is the fracturing fluid? The fracturing fluid is composed of water, sand, and chemical. Water basically is the delivery mechanism for the sand and the chemical. The sand is pumped into those fractures and it holds them open. It acts like a prop, because otherwise if you decrease the pressure on those fractures, they'll close right back up. So the sand is in there to keep it open, to increase permeability and porosity, and the chemicals are used to treat the reservoir rock to increase production. Depending on the chemistry of the reservoir rock, you may have to balance pH, or maybe there's a gelling agent to carry the sand grains all that distance to the fracture to keep them suspended instead of dropping out of solution, or maybe you have to balance bacterial needs in the wellbore. So when a well is produced, all those fluids should come right back out of those fractures, go to an approved containment area, and it is disposed of properly. We'll talk more about that down the road. This slide is an example of a well that was drilled down to about 6,000 feet. The following slide we'll talk about is a well that was drilled at a shallower depth where you can have communication problems with aquifers. Here, just the basic construction of the well. Here's the shallow groundwater aquifer, and the well is entirely cased all the way to total depth, and then it is cemented in the ground to stop fluids from migrating from the reservoir rock up into those shallow groundwater aquifers. So that's one thing that we want to prevent. So where do they occur? And so this on the left is a picture of where the gas shales occur in the nation. And this basically shows where the gas shales are currently in production. Note that there's nothing identified in Oregon, but that does not mean that we don't have shale deposits in Oregon, which I'll explain. But basically, some of the major shales that have been in the news are the Marcellus shales, which is right here, the Barnett, the Bacon, and the Colorado group. Those are major gas-producing areas, and without subhorizontal drilling and hydrofracturing, those would not be at economic levels. Moving to Oregon, yes, we do have shales and coal seams within our state, and the base map is basically the sedimentary basins that we have in Oregon where hydrocarbons exploration could be of potential. So the Miscast field and the Coos Bay coal bed methane deposit is located in the Western Tertiary Basin. Deep marine environments where you could have some more additional hydrocarbons there. Another area where we have a large deposit of shale is in the Columbia Basin area. That area has been drilled in the past in the 60s, identified some gas. At that time, again, it wasn't economical. Those wells were not hydrofractured at that time. But that area is not a current area of exploration. So what are the potential impacts? So this slide just talks about the potential impacts in drilling in general, whether it's hydrofracturing or not. So the first thing we do is we review the well pad site. Prior to development, we want to make sure we identify if there's any threatened, endangered, or sensitive species on the well pad. We might have to change the location to maybe a better location over here where those critters and creatures do not occur. We also want to make sure that the sumps and drilling fluids are controlled in a way where they're not allowed to discharge to waters of the state, estuaries, or other water bodies. Additionally, we want to make sure we don't contaminate the groundwater. So during the process of the permitting, we review the construction of the wellbore to make sure that we're isolating off all of those freshwater drinking zones or other aquifers that don't have saline fluids or salt-bearing water or gas in there so that we're not commingling fluids. And then, of course, there's the public health and safety concern. We want to make sure that the rig hands are operating the well in a safe way. We want to prevent well blowouts through blowout prevention testing. And we also want to make sure that we don't cause fire to the surrounding area or community. Specific to hydrofracturing, it's basically commingling of fluids, where fluids coming back out of the wellbore do not make it into a shallow drinking water zone. So there's a couple things to there. So that is, how is the well properly constructed and how are those aquifers cased off and cemented away from the drilling fluids? But then it's also, where are we fracturing with respect to the location of any domestic water supply sources, seeps or springs that enter waters of the state. We look at offsite well data, where those are, how the depth of drilling, maybe it's down at 6,000 feet, or maybe it's shallow, to see if hydrofracturing could occur in that area or not. The other problem that can occur at other sites is where they fractured, and they fractured through the top of the cap into a freshwater zone. And maybe their resource rock is also the same resource rock that they're getting their freshwater from. And then instead of fluids traveling up the wellbore in a controlled fashion, you have fluids traveling downstream in the underground aquifer. So that is a serious situation that we want to prevent. So who's the permitting agency? And so as an example, permit comes in and we circulate out to all natural resource agencies for comment. Specifically for hydrofracturing, we worked with DEQ, Water Resources Department, and the County Planning Department, and kind of formed a coalition group in 2003 so that we can communicate to the industry what are the regulatory needs, what needs to be in an application, what's the background water quality monitoring data that needs to happen prior to development, so that everybody's on the same page and it's streamlined and everybody knows what the expectations are. So what authority do the state has and what agencies? So for Dogami, it's really broad. I have authority for everything downhole to prevent an offsite impact. That pretty much catches everything. But then when a well is plugged and decommissioned, I also do reclamation of the well pad. Working with DEQ, they have, of course, EPA delegated authority to regulate the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act. DEQ may require an underground injection control permit because in the fracturing process, water is forced into the ground. Any time they do that, they have the option to require an underground injection control permit. And then once the fluids come back out of the ground, those fluids need to be disposed of in an approved fashion. So they're the lead agency for that. So in general, when a proposal comes in, DEQ reviews fracking fluid for compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act and the Clean Water Act. Although Congress exempted hydraulic fracturing from the Safe Drinking Water Act and Clean Water Act, DEQ has delegated authority for UIC, and they can require to regulate the injection in spite of the exemption, the 2005 exemption.
Interesting.
So that concludes my talk.
Okay, thank you very much. And we've got 2 minutes for questions. Could you just review how many active wells we have?
Right.
Here,
so current active wells, Chair Dingfelder, is 104. 82 of those are in the Mist gas field, and that's a conventional gas field. It's producing gas from a sandstone where hydrofracturing is not needed. Because it is sandstone, permeability and porosity is so great, there's actually like 21 wells that are used for injection. They buy the gas from out-of-state source, they inject it back down into the ground, store it, and then they bring it back out and sell it to market.
And that gas field is located where?
In the Mist gas field in between Portland and Seaside in northwest Oregon, Columbia County. And then there are 22 wells that are still in Coos Bay Basin, south of Coos Bay, drilled for coal bed methane that are still in an exploration status. Those are shut in, suspended, stabilized, and the company is reevaluating how they're best going to develop that resource.
Bob,
okay.
Do you have any that's actually being fractured now?
No.
That was part of my question.
Okay. No.
And then as far as Idaho, that's pending because they're waiting for their permits. Is that correct?
Correct. As I understand it, They drilled 11 wells. They proposed to fracture 4 of those. It's still under review with the Idaho Division of State Lands.
And I'm assuming that Representative Bentz, his concern was whether that would have potential impacts on aquifers in Oregon.
Correct. And whether or not that would increase the potential of drilling on our side of the river.
So as a follow-up to that, is there any requirement to consult with Oregon agencies in that permit process?
Correct, yeah. If a permit comes in through our process to drill a well in Oregon, mm-hmm. then it would trigger this coalition of agencies, natural resource agencies. The ones that don't have a direct permitting, mm-hmm. like Water Resources Department, they have the ability to, or Fish and Wildlife, they have the ability to comment during our process, and I can condition the permit to mitigate their concerns.
Follow up. So, but on the same time, if you got an aquifer or something that's below, not knowing how far those could go, and you're saying that they're 5 miles off, I don't know where the wells would be, but horizontal drilling is going to give them the opportunity to potentially come into an area that, you know, we may have a little bit more uncomfortness.
Correct. All right, so in that scenario, I would require a background water quality data before anything were to happen. And then us, with all the other agencies, would take a look at that seriously to see if they're impacting that aquifer.
But are we monitoring? I think what the chair is asking, I mean, if you got stuff happening in Idaho and they're
right
going through their
process.
Right on
the border, near the border, right.
Oh, I see.
Have some type of connection to know, are they giving us that data and we're saying, wait a second, now you're getting close to.
Right, do we have an opportunity to comment on Idaho permits that potentially could impact Oregon aquifers?
No.
Do they give us?
DEQ may have a role, but.
Well, and Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's interesting because Idaho is not a delegated EPA
right.
state. So that makes it even harder. Mm. But that it is an issue that we haven't had come up yet, other than what was going on there. The Idaho rules did pass, what did you say, yesterday or? So there is something to look into there. But
well, I'll follow up with Representative Bentz on that. And then one final question is regarding on federal lands. I'm assuming this is mostly private. Do we have any jurisdiction? Does that trigger a NEPA nexus if there's any permit requirements on federal land?
Correct. Yeah, we would go through our same process of the permitting and agency review. We would also work with the BLM through their process at the same time.
Chair Dingfelder, Gary Lynch again. Basra, the question of primacy or whether we have authority on federal land, we've been through that many times. And we do have the authority. As new people come into the BLM, they may have a different opinion of that, but we always work it out.
Hopefully the statute is clear.
One question. What are our resource potentials in Oregon? Do we have potential for oil and gas and things like that?
The history, we have about 590 wells drilled since 1953. They've had identified lots of shows of gas, minor amounts of shows of oil. Nothing economic at this point. If you look at other states with drilling potential, Oregon is currently underexplored.
Yeah, but I think the point is that with fracking and stuff like this, it makes it potentially economic.
Yeah.
And so.
Correct.
Yep. Okay. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I apologize I ran over a little bit. I'm sure we'll be having some follow-up discussions. And if you have additional questions, I would encourage you to contact the department directly. But appreciate your time here today. With that, we are adjourned until next year.